Did you all have a chance to take a look at this question here? This is a, it's also a classic board type question, but also important for you to understand physiology and treatment of patients with hypoxemia. So see if you can get an answer in here and we'll... Okay, so this answer, right to left shunt, is correct. These two causes of hypoxemia would be related to a diffusion problem, increasing the time it takes to get oxygen from the alveolus into the blood. So if you enrich the gas, add supplemental oxygen, it'll increase the driving force that can overcome that diffusion abnormality. High altitude, the FiO2 is low, so if you give a higher, the atmospheric pressure is low, so if you give a higher FiO2, then you can return that driving pressure back to normal. VQ mismatch can be corrected. Remember the uneven distribution of the breadcrumbs in the second analogy. Remember the different size pots of water, amounts of water. If you have a maldistribution of the gas, it could be overcome by turning up the flame. Even though they're maldistributed, if the flame's high enough, the gas is enriched, you have a high enough driving pressure, you'll still have fully saturated blood. You can overcome the desaturation. Right to left shunt, no matter what you do to the blood that's going in the lungs, you can't get much better than 100%. So when it mixes with blood that is less than 100%, you'll always have blood in the admixture that is not fully saturated. Of course, if you drive the pressure up high enough and have enough dissolved blood, and the shunt is small enough, you may still be fully saturated. Okay, so today we're going to talk about control of breathing. And as any living person who is aware of his or her breathing, I'm sure knows, the control of ventilation, there are two different ways ventilation is controlled. One is automatic and one is voluntary. And the automatic is really key. That's controlled by the brainstem. So even if there is a brainstem lesion, your cortex is not functioning, you'll still breathe. You'll still have normal breathing pattern. If you have a lower brainstem injury, you can get very strange patterns of breathing, and you'll learn a lot about that in your neuroscience course and the medical students on neurology rotations, because abnormal breathing is one of the diagnostic signs of different infarcts in the brainstem. A lot of work has been done in animals in terms of trying to ablate various areas of the brainstem to try to figure out what the function is of different areas, and so there are all sorts of neat changes in breathing patterns that you'll hear about. But there are also voluntary influences. If there weren't, I wouldn't be able to give this lecture. You need to be able to control your breathing. If I asked you to hyperventilate right now, double your breathing rate, you could do that. Cortical influences can control breathing to a certain extent. They both act, at least in terms of resting breathing, on the phrenic nerve, which causes diaphragmatic contraction. So one thing you should know about, the cells, there are actually pacemaker cells in the brainstem. And these were identified about 10 years ago. It's called the pre-Botzinger complex. It's a group, at least in mice or rats, of like 400 or 600 neurons. It's a cluster of neurons that have pacemaker activity. And this controls inspiration. Remember, during normal tidal breathing, inspiration is active. And if you stop the muscles of inspiration, expiration is passive, because then the chest wall relaxes and the chest wall comes back and the lungs come back to FRC, expiration is passive. It doesn't require active muscle contraction for expiration. Inspiration, during normal tidal breathing, requires contraction of the diaphragm. And if you stop that process, expiration will follow. Okay, so these are the key pacemaker cells. And there are many inputs that modulate this activity. And this is obviously, since it's these areas are newly found, this kind of research in terms of the types of modulators, the types of receptors on these cells that influence normal tidal breathing is of great interest. There have been opioid receptors identified on these cells, which would explain why overdose of opioids, or even not overdose, but opioids themselves cause respiratory depression, because they change the pacemaker activity of these cells. In your neuroscience course, which starts in January, when you have neuroanatomy, this image of the brainstem will look a little bit more obvious to you what it is. You should know about Ondine's curse. Anyone hear about Ondine's curse before? This is actually a medical syndrome, Ondine's curse. It's also called central hypoventilation syndrome, because if you tell a patient that they have Ondine's curse, it might freak them out a little bit, so you need to come up with a little more of a medical description of this. But it's actually in the medical literature called Ondine's curse, central hypoventilation syndrome. And where does this come from? This is from German mythology. And Ondine here is a water nymph. I don't know if you know much about water nymphs, but they have special powers. And they also live forever. Unless, of course, they fall in love, marry, and have a child with a mortal. So if a water nymph is going to do something like that, marry and give birth to the child of a mortal, she's got to have some assurances that this guy's a keeper, right? And so here, Sir Lawrence, won her over, and made a promise that with every waking breath, he would be faithful. So she bought this, they got married, she started to age. Actually, she had a child, then she started to age, and he kind of lost interest. Not a good thing to do to your wife if she's a water nymph. She found him in a barn, in the hay, sleeping with another woman. Also not a good thing. So, you need more time for this one? Right. Let's just see what we got here. Okay. Well, yes. I like this. It's kind of like the audience controlling the story here. I did have three different versions of this, or four different versions, depending on what you pick. All right, so yeah, she did curse him. And what was the curse? Let's see here. Let's see if we get the curse going. Okay, so she said to him, "Yes, you swore faithfulness to me with every waking breath. I accepted your oath, so be it. As long as you're awake, you shall have your breath. But if you ever fall asleep, then your breath will be taken from you and you will die." So, Ondine's curse, central hypoventilation syndrome, there is dysfunction of those pacemaker cells. There are genetic disorders that cause this. Strokes cause this. Where the normal automaticity of inspiration when someone sleeps is impaired. All right. One more here. Okay, so Sir Lawrence, what's his next step? Well, that's number two here, yeah. Whoops. Rush to CUMC for help. Well, okay. Yeah, I wrote him a bad check. And we took care of him here. And this is a video of what was done in the operating room for this patient and for other patients who have problems with automaticity of their pacemaker cells. This is the phrenic nerve. This was done robotically, where a pacemaker was placed around the phrenic nerve bilaterally. And you can watch this being placed here. And this wire comes outside the chest, is placed into a device that is implanted like a heart pacemaker under the skin. There's a control box that can interact with it, so you can turn up the rate and down the rate. And this will deliver a signal and depolarize the phrenic nerve and cause diaphragmatic contraction. And this has allowed patients with central hypoventilation syndrome, either from a spinal cord injury or from a brainstem injury, to be off of a ventilator, which they would otherwise need to be on at night. These patients would have tracheostomies, holes in the trachea, so they could place themselves on a ventilator so when they sleep they would not hypoventilate. And so this therapy is a relatively new therapy that is being explored to treat these patients so they don't hypoventilate at night. Okay, so what are the goals of control of ventilation? The main goals is maintenance of the normal partial pressure of CO2. Why? Because this is related to the acute regulation of blood pH. Okay, the respiratory system is responsible for the minute-to-minute control and maintenance of normal blood pH. And normally, if this is kept in check, this is sufficient to keep oxygen levels appropriate in the lung, the partial pressure of oxygen in the lung appropriate. However, there's also a safety net, so that you need a goal of the system in case this does not guarantee normal oxygenation, that something kicks in if the partial pressure of oxygen falls to increase ventilation. Okay, so again, normally this is control of ventilation is aimed at maintaining normal pH, and normal partial pressures of oxygen follow from that. There is a safety net with low levels of oxygen. Well, that will stimulate and take control over your breathing. Okay, so what do we have in any kind of control system? We've got the controllers. So I talked about that there are controls in the medulla and the brainstem, which are mainly responsible for the automatic breathing. There are cortical centers that you can take control, at least to a certain extent, over your pattern of breathing. There are effectors in any control system. The effectors are the muscles that will act to change the properties of the chest wall, so you can change intrapleural pressure and control the movement of air. Normal tidal breathing, the effectors, diaphragm. With other types of breathing, more forced breathing during speech, intercostal muscles, accessory muscles, your abdominals, your sternocleidomastoid muscles, or other muscles that will come into play to help generate very, very high positive or negative pressures. What else is in any control system? There are sensors, and we're going to talk about these sensors. These chemoreceptors are of critical importance. We'll also talk about irritant mechanoreceptors and J receptors. There are other influences, modulators. So in the pons and cortex, reticular activating system, these all affect the system. Okay, they modulate the response of the system. And that's one reason why in central hypoventilation syndrome, it's generally not a problem when someone is awake. Because the reticular activating system will help maintain normal breathing, adequate breathing, but when someone is asleep, these influences decrease, and then it will bring out the dysfunction of those medullary centers. This is why the response to different drugs that we give is different in someone who's awake than someone who's asleep. This is why patients may have sleep apnea and problems with control of breathing when they're asleep, but not have those problems when they're awake because of these modulators. This is also why you may breathe when you get angry. Emotional things may influence your breathing as well because of these effects of these modulators on the system. So now let's talk about these sensors. Most important ones are these chemoreceptors. You know about to understand the central chemoreceptors. Central chemoreceptors are critical for maintaining normal pH. These are the ones that are most important for control of breathing. Where are they located? On the ventral surface of the medulla. And it is not the pH that they respond to of the blood, it is the pH of the cerebrospinal fluid that bathes these cells. What's special about the cerebrospinal fluid? It doesn't have very much buffer in it. So small changes in PCO2, which diffuses readily across into the CSF, will cause a greater change in pH because there's less buffer in the CSF. Acids, bicarb, can't move directly across into the CSF. It's the PCO2 that has easy access into the CSF and then will reform acid there and change the pH of the CSF. These cells on the ventral surface of the medulla are very, very close to the cells that are responsible for controlling ventilation. What do? Increased hydrogen ion concentration, a decreased pH, will stimulate these receptors to increase ventilation. When ventilation is increased, you blow off more CO2 and you bring CO2 down and pH back up. This will happen within a few minutes. It's a fairly quick system. And again, since the CSF is not buffered, it's a very sensitive system to changes in PCO2. There are also peripheral chemoreceptors. These peripheral chemoreceptors are sensitive not only to pH, but also to PCO2 and PO2. These are famous for detection of hypoxemia because the central chemoreceptors will not increase breathing in response to low partial pressure of oxygen. In fact, the central chemoreceptors in response may become depressed. You rely on these peripheral chemoreceptors to detect low partial pressures of oxygen. Extremely fast response time, within a few seconds. They can actually modulate your breath within a breath. Extremely fast, famous for having a very fast response time. Where are they located? The carotid bodies, bifurcation of the carotids, the aortic bodies, and the aortic arch, the inferior and superior portion of the aortic arch. These have a tremendous amount of arterial blood flow. So even though they use up a little bit of oxygen to keep these cells alive, they're bathed in arterial blood, so they're only seeing arterial PO2. That's what they're responding to. However, these really only kick in when the PO2 drops below 60 or so. So normally, if you have a normal PO2, these receptors are not there influencing your breathing. They'll also respond to acidosis. Since they're sitting in the blood, if you have a metabolic acidosis, you're producing ketoacidosis, you're diabetic and you go into ketoacidosis, that acid, which can't cross into the CSF, can stimulate these peripheral chemoreceptors and can cause incredible increases in breathing. Again, to try to blow off CO2 and bring pH back to normal. Also respond to a low cardiac output. Really unclear reasons, but there are people who are have an extremely low cardiac output, trauma patients, whatever the cause, that their breathing increases, and it's thought to be due to some kind of response by the peripheral chemoreceptors to low cardiac output. Not that important that you remember this. So the hypercapnic ventilatory response, how does the respiratory system respond to high CO2 hypercapnia? Well, most of the response is from the central chemoreceptors. The rest from these carotid bodies or peripheral chemoreceptors. Remember, both of them will respond to increases in CO2. But again, most of the response is from the central chemoreceptors. And let's take a look at what would happen to someone who is breathing, rebreathing CO2. So you could actually create some circuit where you can control the partial pressure of CO2 in the circuit, and then you can increase the CO2. So you can control the partial pressure of CO2 in blood. Wouldn't matter how fast they were breathing. They could breathe 20 liters a minute. Doesn't matter because they're rebreathing the CO2 and you're maintaining that concentration of CO2 constant at whatever you set it at. And so in this kind of experiment, you could see that there's a normal minute ventilation, liters per minute here, with a normal PCO2. But if in the circuit you maintained a high PCO2, just a change from 40 to 45 can double minute ventilation, and going to 50 can virtually triple it. The capacity to increase ventilation in response to small changes in CO2 in a normal healthy subject is really incredible. But notice on this side, the solid line is someone who's awake. If you decrease CO2, breathing slows down not very much, and you're not going to abolish breathing, even with a PCO2 of 30 in someone who's awake, because there are other systems, other modulators, the reticular activating system, that also will continue to drive inspiration even if the CO2 is low. However, in someone who's asleep and loses those influences, a small decrease in CO2 and a rise in pH can make someone apneic, not breathing. At the end of surgery, someone who's on a ventilator, if their CO2 is low and we turn off the ventilator, they will not resume spontaneous ventilation until the PCO2 rises back to the normal range. If they have narcotics for pain control, the CO2 has to rise even higher before spontaneous ventilation will resume again. Again, in someone who is asleep and loses the influences of the reticular activating system. So there's an increased ventilatory drive proportional to the partial pressure of CO2. And it's not very sensitive to hypocarbia, low CO2, when awake, but during sleep, the dashed line, even a small reduction will result in apnea, no breathing. Let's take a look at the ventilatory response to acidosis. Again, hyperventilation is a normal response to a low pH, blood pH. Okay? And again, you won't overcorrect if your pH falls. You'll breathe to get pH back towards the normal, but you never overshoot because then the stimulus for increased breathing will be gone. And that's a general principle in all sorts of control systems. If there's a response, a homeostatic response, it brings it back towards normal. You never quite get there. So in a metabolic acidosis, say your muscles aren't getting enough oxygen, they produce lactic acid or ketoacid in diabetics, the acid won't cross the blood-brain barrier into the CSF. So it's a peripheral chemoreceptors that are stimulated. In respiratory acidosis, in contrast, you have a high CO2, it will cross readily into the CSF, and then the chemoreceptors are stimulated. Now, over time, what will happen? Over time, there's something called a CSF bicarbonate shift. And what is that? With chronic changes in PCO2, there's a slow return of the CSF back to normal. Why? You'll hear next week the kidneys' role in acid-base homeostasis. But the kidneys will start changing the way they handle bicarbonate. And what it ultimately does is if you wanted to hyperventilate for some reason, let's say a low PO2, what would restrict your ability to hyperventilate as much as you might want is that you become very alkalotic. But as the kidneys kick in and start dumping bicarb in the urine, it brings the pH back towards normal and gives you more room to hyperventilate even more. One of the reasons why it takes time to acclimatize the high altitude, and we'll talk about that more at the end of this talk. All right, so see if we can put this together and talk to your neighbor about this one and see what you can do with it. So a patient with emphysema is found to have a chronically high arterial PCO2, 55 millimeters of mercury. What can you say about this patient? What would you expect in this patient? This is minute ventilation. Minute ventilation would be low, pH low of the blood, normal, low. You can read the choices there. But again, this is a patient. You can assume that metabolic rate is not any different in an emphysema patient at rest than anyone else. Talk to your neighbor, see if you can get the answer here. I forgot to add the counter on this, so I don't know how people are responding. You guys need more time? You're okay? More time? All right. Just see your answer again. I stuck the redid the slide with the counter. In a patient with emphysema, we talked about emphysema having very high lung compliance, high lung volumes. Those changes, generally almost any change, any pathology like that, will make the work of breathing harder. In these emphysema patients, they also, it's part of a condition called chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. The obstruction is obstruction of airflow, plus those small airways collapse. It's harder for these patients to exhale. The work of breathing is greater. So if the work of breathing is greater, it's harder to move air. That would tend to favor decreasing tidal volumes, decreasing minute ventilation. What's the limitation, though? They stop and they decrease tidal volumes, the PCO2 is going to rise. And so that would be a limitation, be very uncomfortable, become acidotic and have a high CO2. But chronically, the kidneys will accommodate that acidosis and reabsorb more bicarbonate to buffer this acid and return the pH back towards normal. So what you would find in these patients who have a chronic condition is that it allows them to maintain a low tidal volume and decrease their breathing. It must be a low minute ventilation for the CO2 to be high. That's why the CO2 is high, or hypoventilating. You tell that by the high PCO2. But the pH is going to be back virtually towards normal in a chronic condition because the kidneys will respond to that change in pH and bring the pH back to normal. So the least common answer, the least chosen answer, was the correct one. Any questions about this? Some of this will fall more into place after you learn about the kidneys and have the talk on acid-base. So if you're confused about this, that's okay. Use it as motivation to learn more about this, and hopefully it'll fall into place over the next couple of weeks. Any questions about this? Okay. Now, what limits someone from hypoventilating on room air? Remember, if you go to the alveolar gas equation, if the PCO2 is too high, if patients hypoventilate, the driving force for oxygen goes down. The alveolar partial pressure of oxygen goes down. So it limits people's abilities to hypoventilate. In patients with severe emphysema, severe chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, their hypoxic ventilatory response kicks in because they adapt to the high CO2s. The kidneys bring pH back to normal, so that doesn't maintain normal ventilation. What stops them from breathing less and less and less and less is that at some point they become hypoxic, and the hypoxic drive kicks in. And you'll hear patients described as they require their hypoxic drive. You put a patient with severe emphysema on high levels of oxygen, and their breathing may slow down even more, and their CO2 might rise even more, because you've gotten rid of that hypoxic drive for ventilation. So only sense by peripheral chemoreceptors what happens. You can see here, you lower PO2 in the blood, in the arterial blood, and there's not much of a change in minute ventilation. But as it drops below 60 or 70 here, suddenly there's an incredible increase in ventilation. Why? To drive PCO2 down, to make more room for oxygen in the alveolus, to improve PO2 in the alveolus. Incredible, incredible drive. And take a look at the capacity of a normal person to have a minute ventilation of 50 liters per minute, 10 times normal tidal breathing. Pretty amazing system. It's short-lived, as is the patient with severe hypoxia. This effect, if you try to sustain it, will decrease after about 20 minutes because of hypoxia of the central control centers, the central chemoreceptors. Okay? It slows down the functioning. The functioning of those cells becomes impaired, and so someone cannot sustain this indefinitely. So the ventilatory response to hypoxemia, again, this is PO2, partial pressure. It's a peripheral chemoreceptors are stimulated. The central chemoreceptors will become depressed. Okay, and that's why this can't be sustained. The response abates in time. And don't confuse this with low oxygen content. Carbon monoxide poisoning, you have a low oxygen delivery to cells. You might become hypoxic. Your cell's not getting inadequate oxygen delivery. The PO2 is normal. These peripheral chemoreceptors sense PO2, not oxygen content. If you have all of your binding sites filled with carbon monoxide, those sensors won't know that. They just know that you've got a normal PO2, fine, everything's okay. That's why carbon monoxide poisoning is so deadly, your peripheral chemoreceptors will not detect that. Okay, other receptors. You have mechanoreceptors. Lung stretch is detected in the airway smooth muscle. And it tends to limit inspiration. And there's a famous reflex, the Herring-Brewer reflex, which is talked about in every pulmonary physiology book and is virtually, like, completely unimportant. Okay? So you should know what it is, but also know that it's not really important, except for some reason. I don't know whether people have a certain affection with this name. You'll hear it talked about all the time. There are also mechanoreceptors in large joints and muscles. These are thought to give you the anticipatory increase in ventilation when you start going up a flight of stairs. You haven't really increased your CO2 much right away, yet your breathing picks up, and these receptors tell those control centers that there's a need that's going to happen very shortly, and you increase your inspiratory drive, your ventilatory drive, in anticipation of that need. They're irritant receptors. And these are famous for airway protection. Go and there's some kind of noxious gas or whatever, and suddenly you cough. I mean, these can control ventilation. They're protective, these irritant receptors, located in the epithelial lining of your large airways, and can cause intense bronchial smooth muscle constriction and also increase ventilation. Another receptors, J receptors. What are J receptors famous for? They're famous for the sensation of impaired breathing, of shortness of breath with congestion, pulmonary venous congestion. Okay, so famous for this question, what mediates shortness of breath during pulmonary congestion? Someone asks you that, it's the J receptors. Like, that's great, wow. Where did you learn that? All right, so it's located at the alveolar capillary wall, and why is this interesting? It's interesting because patients with left heart failure, high pulmonary venous pressures, pulmonary congestion will feel short of breath, and you'll measure blood gas and their PO2 is normal. And you'll say, you shouldn't feel short of breath. You've got plenty of oxygen. What's the reason for this shortness of breath? It's just the congestion, the stretching of the pulmonary venous system will give that sensation of shortness of breath. Operates via cranial nerves 9 and 10. Again, you'll learn more about this when you study neuroscience and neuroanatomy. Okay, there are a lot of terms that describe ventilation, and you need to learn them, and there are some subtle differences between them, but if you sort of study these things and know them, you won't make a mistake, and it's key because certain questions that you could be asked and certain ways patients are described, you'll be sent in the wrong direction if you misinterpret these terms. Apnea is a complete cessation. There's no breathing. Someone is apneic, they're not breathing. They're making inspiratory efforts, they're not apneic. Okay? Apnea is a complete cessation of breathing. Okay? Apneustic breathing is one that came about from observing certain people with certain strokes in certain locations. There's an apneustic center in the brainstem, and that kind of limits inspiration. They have prolonged inspiration with an inspiratory pause. Okay, this is usually associated with a pontine lesion. Okay, so big inspirations. It's kind of a weird pattern of ventilation. Chain Stokes is a really interesting pattern of ventilation, and I liken this to, have you ever seen someone on a bicycle that starts to lose balance? What happens? It kind of wobbles. It tips one way and the other way, and those control mechanisms become very coarse. Someone on a tightrope, they start to fall. Those movements become very coarse. Okay? You're trying to hold something up that's heavy, and small muscles fatigue. You start to shake because it's coarse muscles that are trying to maintain a constant position of your limbs. When the control mechanisms become impaired, you don't have fine-tuning to keep something right where you want it. So in Chain Stokes ventilation, there's an alternating pattern of hyper and hypoventilation because this control becomes very crude. Patients with heart failure, where the change in PCO2 in the blood coming out of the lungs, reaching the brain becomes slower with low cardiac output, there's a greater lag, a greater response time, and the control becomes more crude. And so patients with heart failure often have chain strokes breathing. It's periods of hyperventilation and hypoventilation. Patients with sleep apnea have chain strokes breathing, periodic breathing, periods of apnea. They're not breathing, the CO2 builds up, stimulates breathing, they hyperventilate and drive CO2 down low, and then they stop breathing, and the CO2 builds up, and then they breathe a lot. And it's that kind of crude control where it's not keeping it steady. It's an alternating pattern of hyper and hypoventilation. Chain strokes, very important pattern of ventilation. Hyperpnea means deep breathing, taking deep breaths. And it might be appropriate to take deep breaths. It's not saying whether it's appropriate or not appropriate. But hyperventilation is inappropriate ventilation in that you're driving PCO2 lower than normal. So if you're exercising, you're running around, and you're breathing up a storm, your minute ventilation is 20 liters per minute, are you hyperventilating? Probably not. The reason why you're breathing fast is because of a high CO2 that you need to get rid of. Your CO2 is, if you're normal, is going to be normal, and you're not hyperventilating. Don't get confused with that term. Hyperventilation means low PCO2. Hypoventilation means high PCO2. Kussmaul breathing is a pattern of breathing where it's incredibly intense, incredibly fast and deep breaths. And it's normally associated, if you see it, you'll be very impressed with it. A patient with, let's say, metabolic acidosis, a young patient with severe diabetic ketoacidosis comes into the emergency room trying to bring pH back to normal. Watching someone move 40 liters per minute of air is an incredible thing, to watch that kind of breathing. It's called Kussmaul breathing. And tachypnea just means, just like tachycardia, tachypnea is a fast breathing rate. And what's too fast depends on age. Infants are supposed to breathe more quickly than you are. If you came in breathing at 30 breaths per minute, I'd say you were tachypneic. Okay? If you're an infant breathing at that rate, that would be normal. Okay? But tachypnea means inappropriately fast breathing. Again, it doesn't say anything about what the PCO2 is. You may need to be tachypneic if you're having trouble getting CO2 out. Okay, let's try to put this together in one example of high ventilation, of high altitude, and the response to that. I sort of alluded to this in a couple of these. So let's say you climbed Mount Rainier, altitude of 14,000 feet. The atmospheric pressure up there is 450. You would calculate the driving pressure, the partial pressure of oxygen in the atmosphere there after it's humidified as 0.21 times 450 minus the water vapor pressure. Again, this will be constant at body temperature. Okay, that would give you an inspired partial pressure of oxygen of 85. Once you subtract the PCO2 divided by the respiratory quotient, if it's normal, 40 divided by 0.8 would be 50, then the PaO2 would, in the alveolus, would only be 35. So it can't possibly be higher than 35 in your blood. Okay? And that's inadequate. You would have almost half of your hemoglobin unbound. Okay, so what's the response to that? I'll come back here. So the response to that is the peripheral chemoreceptors are stimulated because of the low PO2. Increase alveolar ventilation. That's going to drive down the PCO2. Your central chemoreceptors are going to detect this alkalosis and say, whoa, slow down. We're becoming alkalotic. Slow down. But those peripheral chemoreceptors are kicking in saying, speed up. And there's that tug of war. But you're going to increase your alveolar ventilation. Okay? pH is going to increase, limiting the increase in alveolar ventilation, but still going to be high. The kidneys are going to kick in, dumping bicarbonate, which is going to take some hours to days. If you anticipate climbing a mountain, you might take some drugs that will cause the kidneys to dump bicarbonate and before you start climbing the mountain to speed up the acclimatization process. But as a kidney is dumped bicarbonate, your pH, you become less alkalotic, and therefore these peripheral chemoreceptors can have their way, and alveolar ventilation further increases. Okay, what else is going on? The hemoglobin concentration increases because O2 content is reduced, since not all of the binding sites are filled. So you want to increase the concentration of hemoglobin to try to normalize O2 delivery. If you drop PCO2 down to very low values, 14 or 15, you can maintain the alveolar partial pressure above 60, leading to an O2 sat above 90%, which would be compatible with life. Okay, so again, it could take a few days for the kidneys to dump enough bicarb so that you can hyperventilate to allow you to stay at that high altitude. Okay, what can happen in acute mountain sickness? The hypoxemia, remember this, hypoxic pulmonary vasoconstriction, because the lungs will say, whoa, there's a low oxygen tension here, don't send blood over here. And that's very helpful if you have a localized pneumonia where you don't want blood going to that region because it's not going to pick up oxygen, goes somewhere else. But if the lungs globally have a low partial pressure of oxygen, then it's going to vasoconstrict everywhere. And it's not redistributing blood to a better area. No area is better than any area. So you'll have global pulmonary vasoconstriction. That will cause the PA pressures to rise, promoting movement of water from the vasculature into the air spaces, and could lead to pulmonary edema, high altitude pulmonary edema, causing acute mountain sickness. You can also go into right heart failure due to the acute increase in the right ventricular afterload. Okay, so we'll pick up tomorrow. Tomorrow we're going to have a demonstration of pulmonary function tests, which puts together the mechanical factors as well as blood gases. It'll show you how we measure these in patients. We're going to do a demonstration as well as a lecture in the first hour and demonstration in the second hour. See you tomorrow. You like that one?